Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Tuesday, June 21st, 2022. Good afternoon, Dave. Happy summer.
Hey, happy first day of summer to you too, Melody.
Yes.
Longest day of the year.
How about that?
Some say it goes downhill from here, but it's all a part of the circle of life as we know it.
Yes, it is. So,
summer solstice.
Yes, so it's good to. But you know, we're having such cool temperatures. We're just in the mid 70s for the first day of summer. But come August, we'll be complaining. Oh my gosh, it's so hot, you know. And then comes winter. Oh my gosh, it's so cold. We think we'd be able to come up or just ignore those extreme temperatures that we receive in any one season. But we always have to complain about it. So
that's sort of like a microcosm of our politics, right?
Yes.
One extreme to the other.
Yes, there
we
go.
All just get along.
We just got to complain. Well, some politics, those are the reasons to complain, but
indeed.
And today I'm going to complain about gold. They had a little pressure on gold. I mean, the markets are crazy today after a three-day weekend, and, you know, we have another one coming up next week, so I think you're going to see a lot of light trading. We ought to look up to see, you know, what actually is, you know, the amount of trades that have gone on, the volume of trades today, but it's probably very light considering the numbers that we see and with a little bit of pressure on gold. So it was down $8 today at 1831. Silver today was up 6 cents at 21.72. Platinum was up 8 at 948. Palladium was up 28 at 1960. And remember, folks, gold did trade yesterday in the aftermarket. So again, it's, you know, it doesn't have anything to catch up to or like the paper markets did today. So the USDX today was just down slightly 0.06 at 104.42. Crude oil was up a buck at 110.58. Paper markets today, the Dow was up 641 points, 30,530. S&P was up almost 2.5%, 3,764. The NASDAQ was up 2.5%, 11,069. Asian markets, I didn't have a chance to. Everything was higher except China. They were lower, but just barely 8 points. Whoopie-doo. European markets were all strong, all positive, but no really big gains. They were all under 0.5%. 10-year yield, 3.307% on the 10-year. And natural gas had another down day, about 1.3%, 6.851. Brent was higher, but just marginally. WTI was up almost 1% at that 110 that I have mentioned. So kind of a interesting day, but I think, again, it's probably low volume in trades and holidays and this and that, and so no one's going to really pay much of attention, I think, until after the 4th. I think people probably took this week off and, you know, major holiday travel this week and next week. So we'll have to see where it all heads from there. And I think I thought I had, here we go, the let's see, where are we going to go here today? We talked a little bit about this yesterday. The housing market, we have the sales of existing homes in May. That dropped 3.4% to a seasonally adjusted annualized rate of 5.4 million units. We have sales 8.6% lower than in May of 2021. This is April sales were revised a little bit lower as well. So these are the weakest readings since June of 2020. And, you know, it's, and again, what's being blamed for is the pandemic. When everything was shut down, nobody could go anywhere. Nobody could go to work. So now, and you know, that is totally different. People can't go to work and they can't process work and so forth. That's totally different than what it is today. This is, I think, a totally different reason why these things are dropping as much. Of course, it is the rising rates, along with the rapid home price appreciation that we had, the low supply, and, of course, now we see these, you know, 30-year mortgage rates at 6%. That's going to put a big damper on the housing market. And I think you'll soon start seeing some layoffs coming in this industry, if we haven't already, Dave.
We have. Redfin, the online Redfin and Compass announcing 8 and 10%. Layoffs. Now, I haven't seen any of like the Century 21 or Remax or what have you, but you can be sure that they're going to at least start to stop hiring newbies at some point soon.
And also when it comes to like the, you know, the Century 21s and Remax and so forth, the realtors, if they just stop, I mean, they're not even included as layoffs, are they? Because they're independent contractors.
Yeah, but they, I'm pretty sure. I've seen them in counts before, so I'm not sure how they're counted. But they are. And you're right, 95% of realtors are or independent contractors. They get 1099'd.
Okay. What else you got to tell us about that, about the sales of pricing on homes?
Well, we see that the average price, actually it's the median price of houses that sold in May, over $407,000. That's up 15% from a year ago. In fact, it's the highest price on record since at least Realtors.com started tracking it in the late 1980s. Supply is a reason that they're throwing about a lot. Likely why there's less activity, particularly on the higher end of homes. But homes priced between 100 and 250K dropped 27% from a year ago. The other end, you know, homes between 750 and 1 mil were actually up 26%. Homes above 1 million up 22% over the past year. So, but right now, there's houses are still selling fairly quickly, and I'm sure we're going to see this start to stretch out with more inventory. But houses staying on the market just 16 days after listing, and that's the lowest on record. First-time buyers made up just a little over one quarter of all transactions, down from closer to one-third a year ago. Affordability is clearly hitting them the hardest with the increase in mortgages, as well as rising rents for those who don't own. So we'll see. We'll be talking more about that, the housing market, in the third segment, Melody.
Yes, you will be. And we have... You know, there's always these economic reports that come out from these. And, you know, we kind of make fun of them once in a while because they're always wrong. And they're always overshoot expectations. I mean, it's just like when, you know, earnings, well, you know, expectations was this. And they're always low enough. So companies always beat the expectations. And it's just a dog and, you know, it's just, I don't know if you want to call it a dog and pony show, but it makes everybody feel good. It makes the stocks rise. And So now we have these economic reports where they're beginning to fall short of expectations. Usually they're, so it's kind of like the opposite. And we saw on last Friday's report on industrial production, production failed to match consensus Wall Street forecast. Factory output declined 0.1% in May. The forecast was 0.4. So there's a pattern that is beginning to, a trend that is beginning to appear. There was a Thursday report showing housing starts dropped 14% in May compared to April. They were expecting only a 0.2% decline. The day before, we learned that the retail sales unexpectedly fell 0.3% from April to May. Hey, they were expecting a gain, a 0.2% gain. So they're really off. And the June 10th CPI for May showed inflation worsening with prices rising 8.6% year over year. But everybody thought it would be 8.2%. So it just goes to show you how wrong they are. But it also supports what we've been saying, too. Dave.
Yeah. In fact, this economic data or these economic data are now falling short of expectations by more than we've seen since the beginning of the pandemic. There's actually an index that follows this stuff, actual economic metric movements compared to consumer or business or economists' expectations.
A surprise index.
Yes, the U.S. Economic Surprise Index, run by the Too Big to Fail Citigroup.
They have too much time on their hands.
Yes, it shows how these data compare with consensus expectations. High numbers mean data have been better than expected. Lower numbers, worse. Well, the latest index is at negative 62.8. Pretty bad. But it's not as bad as it was in the early days of the pandemic when it fell to negative 150 almost. But it is down significantly from a positive 280-ish a few months later into 2020 when it's peaked there and gradually declined ever since. I haven't read an analysis of, you know, why that is. But the bottom line, well, the Fed's raising rates to slow the economy and rein in inflation. And based on widespread expectations, Melody, it appears a slowdown is on the way.
If it's not here already, we got to remember they started QE back in September of 2019. With the overnight funding. That's when all these injections started going into the markets. And that was way pre-pandemic. So this economy had problems going way back. And I've said so many times, just can't shut down world economies and not expect something, you know, that we just go along without a beep in anything, especially when everything is so artificially upheld, when it's all artificial driven by money injections from the federal and the central banks. So, and I saw a comment earlier today kind of irritated me where it said, well, we're going to talk about Powell here in just a few seconds about his... He needs to really be concerned with what he's doing and so forth because it has an impact on our economy and global economies. So, you know, let's just worry about our economy. And but it's another sign of just how interconnected we are. It's not just what happens here affects everybody. It's what happens everywhere else that affects everybody. You just can't pick and choose what is good and what is bad, because it hits us all. So we have the Powell, Fed Chair Jerome Powell, increasingly struck Fed watchers as much less sure-footed than a few years earlier. How was it easier a few years earlier? Powell, they note, could become the first Fed chair since Paul Volcker in the early 80s to be faced with stagflation, a miserable combination of slow economic growth, with rising unemployment and high inflation. Last week, we know Powell engineered a 75 basis point increase of the Fed's short-term interest rate. You have to go all the way back to what, 94 or the early 90s to have that type of a rate hike? And before that, you do have to go all the way back to Volcker. So this was an unexpectedly aggressive move after Powell had made clear just, 30 days earlier that just a more modest half-point rate hike was coming. Now, to me, I don't think a half-point rate hike is modest, not in today's world. So, and how big is it from a half-point rate to a 75-basis-point rate?
Yeah, it's 50% higher.
It is, but it's, but even the half point is high compared to where it was coming from, and again, based on our economic climate that we're in, we can't afford these higher rates. This economy will fall apart. At the conference last week, Powell's explanation was faulted by some of those Fed watchers, with some complaining that he had failed to articulate a coherent and consistent policy. The Fed was ad-libbing, scrambling to catch up with a painfully higher inflation. This was all according to Mark Zandi. He's the chief economist at Moody's Analytics. We talk about him a lot here. The Fed doesn't have a script and is kind of making it up as it goes from here. Yeah, because we've never been here before. He's going to be making up a lot. They've all been making it up, you know, for a very long time, Dave.
Yeah, well, even Bill Dudley, who's the former New York Fed pres and served with Powell in his early days on the Board of Governors, said the Fed was putting its credibility at risk. And those criticisms are certainly going to echo the end of this week when he heads back to Capitol Hill to give his semi-annual testimony to House and Senate Finance Committees. In fact, about a year after he said that inflation was, Melody,
transitory?
Thank you. And more importantly, that it would wane. And we know that, well, it was not transitory and has not waned. Ethan Harris, who is at the Bank of America, says our worst fears around the Fed have been confirmed. They fell way behind the curve and now are playing a dangerous game of catch-up. Well, related concern is that the Fed and Powell will keep raising rates until there's clear and compelling, in Powell's words, evidence that inflation is headed toward the Fed's 2% target. But that takes months to slow the economy. It's not going to be a pleasant time as the Fed overreaches, Melody.
Absolutely not. 1-800-375-4188. We're heading into a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter and blog. And again, folks, I can't see this turning around. We might have some bouts of positivity, maybe, where everybody will start feeling good. Maybe something will work in your direction. But if we look out any further than a year, at, you know, and I'm just trying to be a little optimistic here, but it's, I don't see anything that can give us a lot of sunshine on the horizon. These were all bubbles that have been created over the years through all the central banks, our own, and this just isn't going to turn around. So there's been trillions of dollars lost with the crypto markets, in the stock markets, just trillions. It was, what, $2 trillion in the crypto? There was another $3 trillion out of the, you know, I don't know how many trillions out of the technology sector. There was someone I saw this morning that, you know, mentioned all these trillions, and there were so many of them I couldn't keep track of them. But you're talking, there was like $5 or $6 trillion lost, Dave.
Yeah, over 9 total.
Is it nine?
9, yeah, since
very short period of time.
The last peak.
So $9 trillion. Does your financial planner tell you that? Do you really think we're going to come back from that? Do you think $9 trillion is suddenly going to be recreated? 1-800-375-4188. Chinese manufacturing, they're down as much as 20% to 30%. This is according to logistics sources responsible for moving the finished products from Chinese manufacturing plants to the ports. Although Alan Bear, the CEO of Ole USA, some industries are forecasting purchase orders reduction of 20 to 30%, while others see no interruptions in their order flow. Overall, the risk appears to be to the downside. The decrease appears tied to economic uncertainty and not the migration of operations out of China. Who buys the most stuff out of China? Economic uncertainty from within China or from around the world or from the USA? Have we stopped buying those trinkets yet from China? It's important to note that even with the decrease in orders, the number of orders is still above these pre-pandemic levels for now. So supposedly this decrease will have no impact on the current container volumes leaving China bound for the U.S. But when were those purchases made? How many months ago?
Yeah.
So that's not a good sign.
Well, even they're saying even when Shanghai fully reopens, the surge of containers are still going to take 6 to 8 weeks to arrive on our East Coast. So when there's a lag of almost 2 months, I'd say get ready to order your holiday items early, do your Christmas shopping earlier even this year than the last two, but not sure what's going to be available for purchase.
And well, I don't even think it's a matter of what's going to be available for purchase. It's a matter of people having money to purchase. So I think you might begin to see, because people can't afford what's going on with the pricing of everything, with the food, with energy. It's not, they're not going to be buying anything that they are not going to need. They're going to be a little more selective in the things that they do, so that they will be cutting back. And especially now, if we start seeing the homes beginning to decline, the purchasing of homes beginning to decline, you're not going to have people buying furniture. You're not going to have people buying refrigerators, the new stoves, new microwaves, new TVs. It's all going to decline. And everybody talks about and tries to figure out what the next recession, what the next big risk is to the U.S. economy. People use the word recession. People use the word deflation. People use stagflation. Some use depression. It's all bad. You could probably fit us into all of those areas. It's 80% of the economists in this survey named stagflation as the greater long-term risk to the economy. Now, the survey was done by the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. The next biggest risk was 13% identified as deflation. Deflation is where prices of goods and services are actually going down. It happens when supply for a given good or service is higher than the demand for it. But I digress. Recent Bank of America Global Fund Manager survey found fears of stagflation are the highest that they've been since 2008. Stagflation is by far and away the most popular description of what the economic backdrop will be in the next 12 months. Now, you had stagflation that was coined in the 70s. Where there was simultaneous high inflation and we had stagnant economic growth and even high unemployment. So while there were some nasty recessions back then, many economists aren't expecting a return to anything like that now. I disagree. John Hopkins economics professor Jonathan Wright, and these are the guys that are supposed to get big bucks. They're always wrong, but the sense in which you had stagflation in the 70s is not one he thinks is at all in the cards. However, high inflation is prompting the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates, and that is tightening the monetary policy, Dave.
Well, he says with that, Wright does, that it's quite likely the unemployment rate will rise, in his words, a fair bit from where it is now. But he says the result may be a mild recession. Stagflation may happen if a recession sets in before inflation has fallen to where the Fed wants it to be, which is, again, roughly 2% of core PCE. I just don't see anything close to that, maybe double that, probably closer to 5%. And look, if headline employment were to go up to 5%, it probably means that actual unemployment is going to be closer to 10 at that point. But headline at 5, CPI inflation at 5, that would be a kind of stagflation, though they say not to the degree we experienced in the 70s when, of course, inflation was a heck of a lot higher, as was headline inflation, although it was measured. Both were measured much differently back then. In any event, Wright says that will mean in the near term the labor market may cool simply by having fewer vacancies. But not everyone agrees that stagflation is even inevitable. Josh Bivin, surprisingly. I follow him. He works for the Economic Policy Institute. He doesn't believe it's a high probability. And I'm not quite sure why, other than he, I think, sees that if unemployment starts to rise pretty rapidly, he thinks that will cause inflation to start coming down pretty rapidly. So we will see a whole bunch of scenarios out there, Melody, but certainly if we're not on the verge of a recession now, and we'll certainly know more about that in a couple of weeks in July when we get the second quarter numbers, boy, it just seems with this aggressive rate hiking that businesses are going to be really cautious in anything new they're looking to do, and certainly consumers, as you suggested, that'll come just in time for holiday purchase cutbacks. I see it just pretty well. If nothing else, it's a pretty doggone uncertain period.
Well, I mean, there's people out there who are saying we're already in the recession, and you know, I don't know, you know, recession, deflation, stagflation, depression. It's to me, it's going to be all of that, because I really do believe we're heading into something that they've been able to pull us out because of their abilities to inflate these markets with all these injections with their monetary policy. That's over. They don't have the ability to do that any longer, because everything else is at a point where whatever they do, there's going to be, where there's an action, there's a reaction. So far, they've had all these actions, but they never had a reaction. Rarely. 2008 was the last time. But they've always been able to pull us out of all of these recessions and whatever you want to call them. This time, I don't think they have the power to do that. I don't know if the right. And so it's just a matter of time until they actually come out and admit our problems. And we continue to see the prices of, or not the prices, but the rates continue to rise. I mean, they're looking to, the Fed is looking for another 75-point move in July. And that would push the Fed funds rate as high as 3.5% by the end of the year. It would hit 4% next.
Yeah, well, I mean, compared to zero, I mean, 3-4% sound pretty high, even 5%. But in the whole historical scheme, I mean, a lot of people are saying the problem the Fed is in now is that they let interest rates go so low for so long that they're barely going to have enough room to adjust the other way, you know, if the economy tanks. I should say when the economy tanks further. And, you know, the thing that worries me, too, on the other end of it, is that unemployment is much higher than 3.6% now, because of the just the fallacy of the U3 concept, and even the U6 rate just counts shorter-term discouraged workers. There are a lot of idle people still out there, Melody, and there were even before the pandemic hit. Now, certainly we're better off in that respect, a lot better off than the beginning, you know, like early 2020. But if you're already talking about unemployment closer, you know, to 7.2%, and the Fed's rate hiking eventually resulting in a new round of layoffs, we're in for it.
We are. And, you know, one thing you are right about, you're right. You know, 3.5-4% in historic terms, you're right. But we have never had the amount of debt that we have now. And I think what's going on everywhere else makes these interest rates, makes these rate hikes, it's going to make everything just collapse, because you've got more corporate debt, you've got more government debt, you got more private debt, public debt. You've got, and the last time when he was trying to raise rates, he only got to what, 3.5? And Donald Trump was, oh, you got to lower those rates. The world doesn't know how to work. It doesn't work with higher rates. So you take all that money out of that system, and that's the only way these economies have functioned, is through that money being injected. So it's going to be, he's between a rock and a hard place. There's nowhere else to go. If it begins to unwind, is he going to lower rates then? Then what's going to happen? If he backs off the next 75-point rate, then what's going to happen? Or even a half a point rate, what's going to happen? So it doesn't matter which way he goes. It's going to have because it doesn't matter what he does. The economy is going in one direction and one direction only. And that is all good for gold. And there's always been a saying that gold performs bad, is negative for gold in rising rates. And that's not true. I can go back and bring numbers to you showing that a lot of these analysts will say, rising rates are not good for, that's not true. Some of gold's biggest gains happened during rising rate increases. So we'll have to take a look at that a little bit closer, Dave. What do you want to add to that? Anything?
We've got Christina Hooper, who runs investment strategy at Invesco, says, we saw that gold held its ground after the Fed raised rates by 0.75 percentage point last week. And she says that's because the 75 basis point move was a massive red flag that the Fed is going to push the economy into a recession. And the Fed's hawkish stance is helping to drive up real yields, inflation-adjusted yields. But it's driving safe haven demand for gold, and it's only going to get stronger in the months to come, Melody.
Absolutely. We're in a break. Stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
One more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody off taking care of clients this final segment today. You can reach her at 1-800-375-4188. I just want to close the loop on the brief conversation we were having right before the break about gold. This Invesco investment strategist, Christina Hooper, said she hopes to see higher gold prices. She didn't specify a level, but she does see that in concert with weaker equity markets through the rest of this year, and said that the fear sentiment could be a further factor that helps gold. And although the Fed's path to engineering a soft landing has, well, narrowed in her words, I think it's virtually, well, I think we need more time to see if how narrow or wide it is. Hooper said she thinks it could still be achieved. She thinks although inflation, the threat continues to build, the labor market is still healthy. Says if American workers can remain employed, and that's the big if, the economy should be able to avoid a recession. But this is how these experts couch their arguments with a lot of ifs. Although inflation did hit that 40-year high last month, Hooper said the real fear is the expectation will remain high for the foreseeable future. Now, whether it remains 8.5%+ high or higher, or whether it starts to go back to that 4 or 5% level, well, let's wait and see. But here you go. Same day, Labor Department said inflation was up 8.6% in May. University of Michigan showed consumer sentiment see inflation hovering around 3.3% in the next 3 to 5 years. Now, inflation expectations are relatively low, much lower compared to other periods, like in the 1980s when Fed Chair Paul Volcker raised interest rates so high that it did, in fact, kill inflation but push the economy into a pretty deep recession. Hooper says that in the 1980s, long-term inflation expectations were around 9.7%. That's a little more than three times what they are today. She said, I'm not going to dismiss the current inflationary environment, which is exactly why it's a good time to be a gold investor. Now, just briefly, in the early 2010s, there was a lot of talk about currency wars, the claim that major central banks around the world were in a race to the bottom with interest rates, competitively devaluing their fiat currencies to try to seize an economic advantage. Now that's been turned on its head. If anything, a reverse currency war is underway, with the Fed and other central banks actually tightening to avoid importing inflation. Cycles taking hold where global central banks have little choice but to keep shifting toward tighter money to keep up with their neighbors. If they don't, their currency will depreciate and inflation will get worse. That could become self-reinforcing, resulting in even more global tightening than is warranted, thus raising the risk of tipping the world into recession. And just last week, the Swiss National Bank and the Bank of England raised their interest rates, and the ECB and Reserve Bank of Australia have signaled tightening is on the way. Of course, at the center of that story is the Fed interest rate hikes. Dollars, we know, is a more attractive currency when interest is rising. That's why the dollar index is up 9% this year. The dollar status as a global reserve currency makes inflation pressures higher everywhere else. The flip side of an appreciating dollar is a depreciating euro, pound, Swiss franc, yen, and so on and so forth. That means imported goods in those countries become more expensive, making inflation worse, even if nothing about the domestic economy has changed. And that's particularly acute in small countries that have to rely more heavily on imports than a large, geographically diverse country like the U.S. In Switzerland, for example, imports are more than half of GDP compared to the U.S., where they're just 13%. As a result, those nations' central bankers are under even more pressure to keep up with the Joneses in an attempt to restrain inflation. The problem is trying to rein in inflation through reverse currency wars is ultimately zero sum. In the end, no one wins. Instead of a race to the bottom in the foreign exchange market, we may see a scramble to the top. That's according to Harvard economist Jeffrey Frankel. He argues that poor countries are likely to suffer most as higher borrowing costs in dollars squeeze their economies. Now, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. In addition to Melody's weekly recap of the financial markets, Doug Nolan's weekly blog, and Wendy Wilson's look at monkeypox, I have an article about, yes, the housing market, as we promised in the first segment. Average mortgage rate, as we talked about, is up 80 basis points or 50% in just 1 week. As a result, applications for a mortgage are now roughly one-half the level they were just a year ago. Home builder sentiment at a two-year low. And online real estate companies, as we mentioned, like Redfin and Compass, have announced layoffs of 8 and 10% of their workforces, respectively. So, what can go wrong in the housing industry? Well, despite mortgage rates rising as fast as a Usain Bolt 100-meter sprint, the once red-hot housing market, believe it or not, is cooling off. Home prices are still historically high, but there's growing concern that they'll ease up as well. Buyers had better hope so. The average price of all homes in the U.S. have risen 29% just since the start of the pandemic to $348,000. The median price for a newly built home all over the country is over $450,000. That's unbelievable. We're not talking about our grandparents' housing market anymore. In fact, far from it. All this has people asking, is today's housing market the same as it was over a decade ago when the 2007-08 crash caused the Great Recession? Some, like CNBC's Diana Olick, say the short answer is no, it's not. She argues the country's housing market is in far better condition 15 years after the last housing bubble burst. That, she adds, is thanks partly to new lending regulations that resulted from that meltdown, which tended to substantially reduce subprime loans, among other things. And as a result, those rules put today's borrowers on firmer footing. For the 53-plus million first lien home mortgages in America right now, the average borrower FICO credit score is a record high 751. That's amazing. Really high in 2010, 699, 2 years after the financial sector meltdown. Lenders, it seems, have been much more stringent about lending, especially in the mortgage area, much of that reflected in credit quality of the borrowers. And home prices have soared as well because of pandemic-fueled demand over the past 2 years. They're up 88% over the past decade and up over 125% over the past two decades, that is. That's given homeowners record amounts of home equity. the amount of cash a borrower can loan against their home while still leaving 20% equity on paper, called tappable equity, hit a record high $11 trillion this year. It's a 34% increase from just a year ago. At the same time, leverage, which is how much debt the homeowner has versus their home's value, has fallen significantly. Well, Oleg points out that total mortgage debt in the U.S. is now less than 43% of current home values, surprisingly the lowest on record. And negative equity, which is when a borrower owes more on the loan than the home is worth, is virtually non-existent. She says that compares to more than one in four borrowers who were underwater in 2011. Just 2.5% of borrowers have less than 10% equity in their homes. That's good. All this provides a huge cushion should home prices actually fall. There are about 2.5 million adjustable rate mortgages outstanding today. It's about 8% of all active mortgages, and that's the lowest volume on record. ARMs can be fixed usually for terms of 5, 7, or 10 years. In 2007, just before the last housing crash, there were 13.1 million ARMs, 36% of all mortgages. Back then, the underwriting on those types of loans was sketchy, to say the least, but new regulations, again, following the housing crash, changed those rules. These days, ARMs aren't only underwritten to their fully indexed interest rate, but more than 80% of today's ARM originations also operate under a fixed rate for the first 7 to 10 years. Today, 1.4 million ARMs are currently facing higher rate resets, so given higher rates, those borrowers are going to have to make higher monthly payments. That's definitely a bigger risk, but in 2007, about 10 million ARMs were facing higher resets. So mortgage delinquencies are now at a record low, just under 3% past due. Even with the big jump in delinquencies during the first year of the pandemic, there are fewer past due mortgages than there were before that period. So to give credit where credit's due, that is good news. Now, to be sure, the government's pandemic-related mortgage forbearance programs helped millions of borrowers stave off foreclosure and gave time to recover. There's still 645,000 borrowers in those programs. About 300,000 borrowers have used up their pandemic-related assistance and are still delinquent. That's unfortunate for them. Plus, while mortgage delinquencies are still historically low, they did recently start to trend higher, especially for more recent loan originations. And mortgage credit availability is well below where it was just before the pandemic, suggesting still tight standards, but trending upwards. Banks and other lenders have lost about half their business since rates began rising, and that could mean they'll be more active in lending to less creditworthy borrowers in the coming month and year. Of course, the housing market's biggest problem, affordability, which is at a record low in at least 44 major markets. And although inventory is starting to increase overall, it's still about half of pre-pandemic levels. Danielle Hale, chief economist at Realtor.com, says that rising inventory will eventually cool home price growth, but the double-digit pace has shown remarkable sticking power so far. She adds that as higher housing costs begin to max out some buyers' budgets, those who remain in the market can look forward to relatively less competitive conditions later in the year. Now, Moody Analytics' Mark Zandi goes a step further. A few weeks ago, he said the housing market had actually fallen into correction territory. He said the housing market has peaked. Everything points to a rolling over of it. In fact, over the next year, Zandi expects year-over-year home price growth to be 0%. If that happens, it had marked the worst 12-month stretch since yes, you guessed it, the end of the Great Recession. Okay, last up today, I'll try to get through as much of this as I can. American parents already grappling with rising inflation and economic uncertainty are facing another soaring cost, child care. Almost two-thirds of parents report that child care has become more expensive over the past year. That has many parents concerned about whether they can afford care and what kind of changes they may have to make to accommodate the rising costs. When you think about as a nation how much we're spending on child care and you think about rising costs of goods due to inflation, well, that's a double whammy. Natalie Maeslich at Care.com says people are being hit across all sectors, and it's happening at the same time. The cost of nannies rose about 20% over the course of the pandemic, while babysitting and daycare costs are up 5 to 15%. 51% of parents said they spend more than 20% of their income on child care. 72% reported spending 10% or more. Last year, the average weekly cost of caring for one child was $694 for a nanny, $226 for a child care center. That's $11,000to $36,000 for a full-time nanny. That's a lot of money. Hey, we're out of time. Today's program. I want to thank you for tuning in. Thanks, as always, to our engineer and producer, Todd, and to your loyal listeners. I'm Dave Allen. See you again on tomorrow. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.